Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, John Russell, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
K-pop music is popular in many countries. This popularity has led to a number of young people leaving their home countries and going to South Korea, the center of the K-pop universe. Industry experts estimate there may be up to 1 million music hopefuls seeking stardom in South Korea. Most of these young men and women are South Koreans. But a growing number come from Japan, where K-pop has a huge following. One such K-pop wannabe is 17-year-old Yuka Hasumi. She delayed her high school education in Japan in February and instead went to South Korea in hopes of becoming a star performer. Hasumi knew this decision meant her life in South Korea would not be easy. She would need to spend long hours working on her voice and dance moves. There would be little time for social activities. This meant giving up much of her privacy, having no boyfriend, and little or no use of her telephone. The young woman signed up to attend the Akopia School in Seoul, a preparatory school offering young Japanese a shot at K-pop fame. Akopia teaches students the songs and dance moves, as well as the Korean language. Such training programs are the first step for Hasumi and others trying to prepare for an intensely competitive series of auditions. All the music hopefuls dream of getting invited to perform for major talent agencies. In the end, the agencies accept only a small number of trainees to shape into possible stars. "It is difficult," Hasumi told a Reuters news agency reporter after one of her dance class workouts. She attended the class with Yuho Wakamatsu, a 15-year-old friend from Japan. Hasumi is one of about 500 Japanese who join the Akopia School each year. The program costs up to $3,000 a month. The cost includes training activities and a place to stay. The school can organize auditions for its students with talent agencies. Industry experts say the auditioning process has fueled a Korean wave of pop culture that has spread worldwide over the past 10 years. One of the biggest K-pop groups to explode into stardom was the South Korean boy band BTS. "They're nuts about BTS over there in Japan," said Lee Soo-cho, who belongs to the Seoul Tokyo Forum. The private group has members from the Japanese and South Korean diplomatic and business communities. K-pop's huge popularity in Japan comes at a time when relations between South Korea and Japan have experienced difficulties. Relations have been hurt by South Korean court rulings against Japanese companies for carrying out forced labor during Japan's 1910 to 1945 colonization of Korea. Many South Koreans believe Japanese officials have not done enough to take responsibility for Japan's colonial past. But Lee says K-pop groups and well-known Korean musicians keep performing to large sellout crowds throughout Japan. There is no Korea-Japan animosity there. Rikuya Kawasaki is a 16-year-old Japanese K-pop star hopeful. "I might get criticized for being Japanese, but I want to stand on a stage and make South Koreans know Japanese can be this cool," she told Reuters. Many schools and talent agencies attempt to find new recruits in Japan because it is the second largest music market after the United States. Some Japanese have already made it big in K-pop. The three Japanese members of the girl band TWICE helped make the group a success. TWICE is now the second most popular band in Japan after BTS. Yuka Hasumi is hopeful that K-pop can be good for relations between the two countries. "It will be good if Japan and South Korea will get along through music," she said. I'm Brian Lin.
Patient number one is a thin man with all the hair removed from his head. Years of drug use cost him his wife, his money, and his self-respect. Now, he meets with a surgeon who will operate on him in 72 hours. The doctor plans to cut two small holes in the man's head and connect electrodes to his brain.
Doctors have long used the treatment known as deep brain stimulation, or DBS, for movement disorders like Parkinson's disease. Now, they are performing the first clinical trial of DBS for methamphetamine addiction at the Shuiqin Hospital in Shanghai, China. Patient number one was the first patient in the study. The surgeon plans to implant a device that acts like a pacemaker for the brain. It electrically stimulates targeted areas. Researchers in Europe have struggled to get patients for their DBS addiction studies. In the United States, complex social and scientific questions have made it hard to move forward with studies of the treatment. 8 registered DBS clinical trials for drug addiction are taking place around the world. 6 of those are in China. That information comes from the U.S. National Institutes of Health. Patient number one, whose last name is Yun, said doctors told him the surgery was not dangerous. "But I still get nervous," he said. "It's my first time to go on the operating table."
Before brain implants, there was brain lesioning. In China, families of heroin users paid doctors thousands of dollars to destroy small masses of brain tissue. Many patients had side effects, including emotional disorders and lost memories. In 2004, China's Ministry of Health ordered a stop to the use of brain lesioning. DBS builds on that history. But unlike lesioning, which kills brain cells, DBS devices offer a treatment that is, at least in theory, reversible. In China, DBS devices can cost less than $25,000. Many patients pay with money they have saved up. Li Dianyou is Yan's surgeon. "You can rest assured for the safety of this operation," he told Yan. "It is no problem. When it comes to effectiveness, you are not the first one, nor the last one. You can take it easy because we have done this a lot. In fact, there are risks. Yan could suffer brain damage. He could have had changes to his personality. He could have developed seizures. He may have even gone right back to drugs."
Critics believe the surgery should not be permitted. They argue that these experiments fail to deal directly with the issues that drive addiction. Scientists do not fully understand how DBS works. They still debate where they should place electrodes to treat addiction. Two U.S. clinical trials on DBS for depression failed around 5 years ago. At least two U.S. laboratories dropped clinical trials of DBS for treating alcoholism over concerns about study design. The partial results did not seem to justify the risks, researchers told the Associated Press. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that over 500,000 Americans died of drug overdoses between 2008 and 2017. That is more than the total number of U.S. soldiers who died in World War II and Vietnam combined. In February, the Food and Drug Administration approved a small trial of DBS for opioid use disorder. The FDA did not comment on the action. "People are dying," said Ali Razai, the leader of the study at West Virginia University's Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute on drug abuse. "Their lives are devastated. It's a brain issue. We need to explore all options." Nader Paradian is a neurosurgeon at the University of California, Los Angeles. He is investigating the use of DBS for chronic pain. Paradian said it is an appropriate time to research DBS for drug addiction, but only if we can move forward in ethical, well-informed, well-designed studies.
Yan, patient number one, had his surgery about 6 months ago. He was awake when the doctor used a drill to cut through his skull. The noise made him shake. Later the same day, he was given drugs so he could sleep through a second operation. Doctors implanted a battery pack in his chest to power the electrodes in his skull. Hours after, Yan still had not woken up from the anesthesia. His father began crying. Doctors wondered if his drug use had changed how his body reacted to anesthesia. Finally, 10 hours later, Yan opened his eyes. 2 days after the surgery, doctors turned on his DBS device. When the device turned on, he felt energized. He stayed awake that night. He said he spent the whole night thinking about drugs. The next day, Dr. Li used a tablet computer to adjust the machine connected to Yen's head. The doctor asked how Yan felt. agitated, Yen said. Lee made a few changes. Any feelings now? He asked. Pretty happy now, Yen said. Yen notes that he felt the changes the machine made. It controls your happiness, anger, grief, and joy, he said. 6 months later, Yen said he is still off drugs. His skin has improved, and he has gained some weight. Sometimes, in his new life, Yen touches the hard cable wiring in his neck. It leads from the battery pack to the electrodes in his brain, and he wonders, what is the machine doing inside my head? I'm John Russell.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember with Shirley Griffith. We begin the story of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1932, Americans were tired of the policies of Republican President Herbert Hoover. They thought Hoover had done too little to fight the depression that was crushing the economy. They gave a big victory to Franklin Roosevelt and his Democrats in the elections that year. Roosevelt believed that the federal government should do more to help average Americans. The election brought hope to many Americans in the autumn of 1932. But Roosevelt did not become president until March of 1933, 4 months after the election. And those months saw the American economy fall to its lowest level in the history of the nation.
President Hoover tried to arrange a World Economic Conference, and he called on President-elect Roosevelt to join him in making conservative statements in support of business. Roosevelt refused. He did not think it was correct to begin acting like a president until he actually became the president. He did not want to tie himself to policies that the voters had just rejected. Congress, controlled by Democrats, also refused to help Hoover.
It was a strange period, a season of uncertainty and anger. The economy was worse than ever. The lines of people waiting for food were longer than before. Angry mobs of farmers were gathering in the countryside. And the politicians in Washington seemed unable to work together to end the crisis. Hoover said, "We are at the end of our rope. There is nothing more we can do." And across the country, Americans waited, worried, uncertain, afraid. What would the new president do?
The new president was 51 years old. His family name was well known to the American public. Theodore Roosevelt, a distant family member, had served as one of America's greatest presidents 30 years earlier. Franklin Roosevelt was born to a rich and important New York family. He went to the best schools, Groton, Harvard, and Columbia Law School. In 1910, he won election to the New York State Legislature. He showed great intelligence and political understanding as a state senator, and worked hard for other Democratic candidates. Franklin Roosevelt next served as Assistant Secretary of the Navy under President Woodrow Wilson. And in 1920, he was the Democratic Party's unsuccessful candidate for vice president.
The next year, Roosevelt suffered a personal tragedy. He was sailing during a holiday with his family. Suddenly, his body became cold. He felt severe pain in his back and legs. Doctors came, but the pain got worse. For weeks, Roosevelt was forced to lie on his back. Finally, doctors discovered that Roosevelt was a victim of polio. He lost control of his legs because of the disease. He would never walk again. Roosevelt had always been an active man who loved sports, but now he would have to live with a wheelchair. All of his money and fame could not get him back the strength in his legs.
Many Americans thought the illness would end Roosevelt's political dreams, but they were wrong. He showed an inner strength that people had never seen in him before. Roosevelt ran as the Democratic candidate for governor of New York State in 1928. He won by a small number of votes. 2 years later, the voters of New York re-elected Roosevelt, and they cheered his creative efforts to help citizens of the state who were suffering from the Great Depression.
Franklin Roosevelt always appeared strong and friendly in public. He loved to laugh and enjoy life. But his happy face hid a strong will. Throughout his life, Roosevelt worked to improve life for the common man. And he was willing to use the power of government to do this. He thought the government had the power and responsibility to improve the life of its citizens.
Roosevelt believed deeply in this, but he was less certain about the best way to do it. Above all, we must try something, he said, during the presidential campaign of 1932. Roosevelt believed that the country demanded creative experimentation. Americans in large numbers across the country voted for Roosevelt in 1932. They supported his calls for action to end the Depression. But no one was really sure just what this new president from New York, this man unable to walk, would really do after he entered the White House.
Inauguration Day in 1933 began with clouds and a dark sky. Roosevelt went to church in the morning, and then he drove with President Hoover from the White House to the Capitol, the building where Congress meets. Roosevelt tried to talk with Hoover as they drove, but Hoover said little. He just waved without emotion at the crowd. The two men arrived at the Capitol. A huge crowd of people waited. Millions more Americans listened to a radio broadcast of the ceremony. The Chief Justice of the United States, Charles Evans Hughes, gave the oath of office to Roosevelt. And then Americans waited to hear what the nation's 32nd president would say. He told them he was sure they expected him to speak openly and honestly about the situation facing the country. He told them that their great nation would survive as it had survived in the past, that it would recover and become rich again. He talked about the danger of fear, a nameless fear that blocked efforts to move forward. And he talked about Americans giving their support to honest, active leadership in every dark hour of their history. Here is some of Roosevelt's inaugural address in his own words.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
Roosevelt's words caught the emotions of the crowd. He seemed sure of himself. He promised leadership. His whole style was different from the empty promises of wealth offered by President Hoover.
Happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of creative effort, the joy, the moral stimulation of work. No longer must be forgotten in the mad chase of evanescent profits.
These dark days, my friends, will be worth all they cost us
if they teach us that our true destiny is not to be ministered unto, but to minister to ourselves, to our fellow men.
Roosevelt said that the most important need was to put people back to work. And he said the federal government would have to take an active part in creating jobs. Roosevelt said there were many ways to help the nation recover. But, he said, it would never be helped just by talking about it. We must act, he said, and act quickly.
Roosevelt had a strong and serious look on his face. He told the crowd that all the necessary action was possible under the American system of government. But he warned that Congress must cooperate with him to get the nation moving again. Then, his speech finished, Roosevelt waved to the crowd and smiled. Herbert Hoover shook his hand and left. Roosevelt rode alone through the huge crowds back to the White House, and he immediately began a series of conferences.
Roosevelt's inauguration speech of 1933 was one of the most powerful and important speeches in American history. Roosevelt's speech was like an ocean wave that washes away one period of history and brings in a new one. The president seemed strong. He gave people hope. The new president promised the American people action. And action came quickly. During the next 3 months, Roosevelt and the Democrats would pass more major new programs than the nation had seen in many years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.